This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. Today we have an immensely epic and monumental event because it is our 100th episode and timed perfectly because today on the show we have Andrew Jones, a leader and a very well-known name in our high-performance computing community, currently at Microsoft Azure. Andrew, I am not going to do this introduction justice, but you have worn all of the hats, like software engineer, researcher, consultant, service provider, visionary, and you've touched not just industry, but also more traditional academia and government. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thanks very much for inviting me onto this. I notice it's called Developer Stories. I feel a bit of a fraud. It's a long time since I've done any real development work myself, but hopefully I'll remember something useful as we talk.
I think you probably will. So we do have a lot to talk about with respect to high performance computing and cloud, but I kind of want to start in a different direction. I first want to talk a little bit about you. Can you tell us about your early years, I guess your superhero origin story, about how you got interested in computational or computer sciences in the first place?
I suspect, like a lot of people, I fell into it rather than plan to get into it. I don't know, maybe some people have more of a plan, but I certainly didn't start out life with a career plan, or indeed really have a career plan at any significant point in life. My first job was essentially a research job. So I was researching, and computational science was part of what I was doing. So both writing codes and then using those codes to explore some scientific phenomena, but we're also combining that with physical experiments as well. So that's kind of where I started out, kind of as a user. Somewhere along the lines, I became one of the bigger users of some of our supercomputing equipment that we had at that location. And therefore, I got more and more involved in the high performance computing side of it, particularly when we did, or at least was the first procurement for a new system while I was there. I got involved in helping to build the business case for investment in the next system, helping to talk to suppliers and figure out the procurement and stuff. And that's where I started to get more involved in the technology side of the conversation, as much as the kind of the user and the developer side of the conversation. And from there onwards, my career, not necessarily in a planned way, just kind of by accident, as different opportunities came in front of me, got switched more towards the technology and high performance computing as the career direction rather than as a scientist using the infra.
So there's probably quite a bit of strategy to that. And this is not a role that I've ever been in. I am like the researcher, the user. Can you talk a little bit about when you're on the side of someone that's deciding the strategy for an institution or kind of the vision? What's an example of what that looks like?
I mean, that's a good question. And so I want to start by saying that what I was doing in those early years was probably extremely naive. And I kind of hesitate to think back that far. I probably learned a lot of lessons that are useful later in life, but I certainly would not proclaim these days that I knew really what I was doing when I was younger. But kind of looking back, I went on to other pieces of careers where I spent a lot of time where running procurements or providing business case reviews or whatever, or bidding to run national surveys was a core part of my career. So I went on to other parts where I did a lot more of this. The strategy really depends on the organization. And it comes down to being able to tell a story of what your organization is about and how supercomputing fits into that story. And we have this breadth throughout all the high performance computing community of different people of different places and how strategy fits in. So for example, for some organizations, supercomputing is fundamentally the only way they can do their business. It's absolutely the core and critical asset of what they're able to do. Another, the most obvious example I always use is weather organizations. The only way you can realistically, at any degree of resolution or fidelity, predict tomorrow's weather before tomorrow is to use a supercomputer. So it becomes critical to the mission of that organization, the essence of what they're able to do. And there's a few other use cases that are similar. And then there are other places where, they started out doing physical testing. So, crash testing and automotive and so on. And supercomputing became a better way of doing it. So it became a competitive differentiator rather than, almost the core of how the organization operates. And then there's other places where supercomputing is a tool in what they do, but it's not, but how they do supercomputing is not their competitive differentiator. It's just a tool. So understanding where you are in that spectrum, understanding how you're doing, how supercomputing is contributing to your business. Is it a strategic asset? Is the essence of how you do supercomputing part of how you compete, or is it just a tool that enables something else about how you compete? So that's kind of the first level. Make sure you understand why you're doing supercomputing in the first place.
So one thing I think might be related to that, that I noticed about the HPC community really early on, is that we have these organizations. I'm not sure if that's the right thing to call them, but for example, HPC Now, Inside HPC. And as a superficial observer, they seem like kind of news organizations for the HPC community. And what I don't really understand, though, is how they came to be and like what their goals are. For example, sometimes I feel like they amplify a signal for something that maybe at the time feels a bit hypey to me. And sometimes they feel like they're calling out vendors in a way that is advertising, but other times they're calling out really cool science. So do you know how these groups came to be, like how they're funded and what purpose they're serving?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, probably broader than that. I'll talk about the media organizations in our community, if that makes sense. So HPC Now, I'm not so familiar with it, some of the others, but you're right. We use the word loosely, whether it's media organizations or journalists or news sites or whatever, because they've got the different sites have got different flavors of this. So we have a number of these in our community that, you know, arguably the best known one is HPC Wire. There's the Next platform, which covers it. And then there's Inside HPC, you mentioned, and there's a few others. And they've all grown in different ways over the years, and the different characters has kind of led to them. So Inside HPC is an interesting one. So it started out, I cannot remember the year, but it started out with a guy called John West, who at the time was at the HPC program in the DoD, so at Erdic. And I believe that's where he was at the time, and he's founded this. He's now at TAG. And he's essentially set up this news site to capture, just at a very simple level, the news stories of the week, kind of in a bite-sized way. So it's a kind of a community thing started by somebody in the community. It grew to the point where it wasn't easily just something that John was running on his own. A group of volunteers in the community kind of stepped forward and helped him at one point to keep the site running. I was briefly one of those volunteers. And then eventually John sold the business to Rich, and he's sadly no longer with us, but he really took it on and kind of created the character that we associate with Inside HPC today, which is, I don't want to call it a bit of a lively publication, that gave you the news, gave you the edge on it, had a little bit of an edge of snark maybe to some of the discussions, but that kind of really grew it into that cornerstone of our community that it is now. And then obviously, you know, when sadly Rich passed away at the early days of the COVID, the site was passed on to new hands in terms of Doug Black. But so that's kind of a publication that's evolved over time, which may or may not bore you what you're asking about, but how the different media organizations in our community have different characters. So we talked there about the kind of the journey and character inside HPC, but then other publications. So HPC Wire, for example, has kind of a much richer collection of all of the news, the press releases. So, you know, if you want the most comprehensive selection of press releases relevant to our community, you go find that in the Off the Wire section of HPC Wire, for example. And then if you want some kind of long form, more journalistic analysis of what's going on in the community, you can go to places like the Next platform. And now there's an increasing organizations who or individuals who have built up their, whether it's blogging or news or journalistic or what you will, who talk about our community, not necessarily having started in our community. So Ian Kutris with More Than More would be one, for example, where, you know, he didn't really start out as HPC as the core part of what his publication is covering, but now he touches on that a lot. It kind of feels more and more part of our community. So we're lucky we have a lot of different organizations that report in our sector, but you kind of need to be aware that they all have their different flavors that they bring to play.
Ah, flavors like ice cream or something like that. So I was not just thinking of ice cream. No, maybe it was. So when you're someone that's working on strategy, how influential are these media organizations to your decisions? Because kind of what I'm thinking about is there's almost this opposition in the speed at which we move. So for example, we provision new clusters at our centers very slowly, but then, you know, the speed at which new technologies and news come out is just alarmingly fast. And so there's almost a disconnect between those two things.
There is, but there's probably something in the middle. So, I mean, a news site is driven by telling you new things each week. A news site doesn't function by telling you that the same processor that was the best processor last week is the best processor this week again. They get, you know, news sites function by telling you about something new and different every single week. So they kind of create an impression of a pace of technology change and people moving around and new processors and new technology and so on. Probably it's faster than is reality, or certainly that's faster than moving into production. And kind of the obvious one that we used to, well, that actually Dan Stanzione from TAC used to say, is that I like to buy boring supercomputers because then I know they're going to work and deliver science. I probably paraphrased them horribly there, but that kind of production supercomputing following a little bit behind the news cycle in terms of excitement about new and interesting things. But equally, because you're right, a lot of our biggest supercomputer procurements tend to run over multiple years, and they tend to be towards, you know, buying a capability that's not going to be actually in production for 3+ years. And if the research that goes before that means you're probably looking over a 6-year horizon. So always keeping an idea on how things are moving the market, trying to figure out what the technologies might be in 6 years' time. Not necessarily they're going to go and buy every new thing that comes along, but just making sure you understand enough about what might or might not be changing in the landscape over the course of your procurement program, so that at least you've got the ability to have a reasonable degree of confidence. At the worst case, you haven't gone down the wrong path, and ideally you've gone down the right path.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about some of your experience in the different spaces or flavors of institutions that you've worked in. I'm particularly interested in how it's felt in terms of culture and incentives between maybe more of a traditionally academic or government institution and then something in industry. And I'm interested in the relationship between those two things, because I remember back when, you know, cloud was a very new thing. And to me, it felt like cloud was an external service, like an extension of local resources. And I can't speculate what people that kind of worked in these centers thought, but my impression is that it didn't seem like this direct competitor for resources for the actual customers, I suppose. But my perception is that that changed at some point. And there's also been kind of change in culture along the way. And it's actually now changed into a more competitive landscape than it used to be. Can you speak to that and your general thoughts on the relationship between cloud and HPC?
Yeah, sure. So I actually did a presentation on this last year or so, where I kind of went over the history of HPC and cloud, as it were. Not that I can remember anything I talked about now, but I did actually kind of walk this track going back to what I consider the early days. Anyway, it's the first time I kind of seriously thought about cloud in terms of a HPC context. So if you go back far enough, I was very much a HPC person and cloud wasn't even my thoughts. And then there was a HPC conference in roughly 2009, where the first time I recall seeing cloud providers as part of the agenda. So it goes back quite a long way, a lot longer than I guess many of us would assume. And there's actually two cloud providers presented at that conference, you know, both of whom I've had good interactions with since. But I think the community was pretty, the HPC community was gently curious as to what was going on with cloud, but also pretty confident that we knew it wasn't really relevant to us for the foreseeable future. It was kind of a side curiosity in the same way we might show an interest in a new programming language or something, knowing that it wasn't really going to change the core of what we did. So that was going back a long way. And then it kind of stayed there for a long time, and it gradually started to take over credibility for a few more workloads or a few special cases and so on. And then I don't know quite how many years ago this was, but it kind of burst onto the scene where the cloud providers started to take a serious look at HPC community and say, we can do this stuff. You can do HPC on our cloud. And you started to get all these debates about, you know, whether cloud could actually do real HPC and the relative cost of doing it and what you actually mean by HPC and what you actually mean by cloud and so on. And as you might expect, there was a lot of good collaborations. There was a lot of fud being thrown about on both sides. There was a lot of people talking about exactly the same story and coming to completely the opposite conclusions. And certainly, I think at this point, I was primarily in a consulting role. So helping customers around the world to do business cases and run procurements and assess different technology options and so on. And at this point, kind of the short version, I mean, it changed from customer to customer and context to context, but broadly speaking, the most common outcome of the consulting exercise, having evaluated a business's needs and so on, was don't do cloud, it doesn't solve HPC problems. For a variety of reasons, which we can dig into if you want, but at the time it was just don't do it. And then, so some people know I give these classes on procurements and technology and business cases and total cost of ownership models and all this kind of stuff. And one of the sections of those classes talks about the role of cloud and HPC. And that piece of the course was having to be rewritten, significantly rewritten, more often than any other part of the course as we delivered it kind of every 6 months or so in different environments. And that kind of gave me a hint that something was going on here. If I'm having to rewrite how I'm teaching about this stuff, the underlying technology or the underlying appropriateness of that technology or that community must be changing significantly at the same pace. And it was, and it still is. I mean, kind of the phrase I say now is if you make your assessment of whether cloud fits your environment based on anything other than, you know, information from the last 6 months, then you're making a decision based on out-of-date information. It's changing arguably much faster than the HPC community. And as HPC, we always kind of saw ourselves as the leading edge and the fastest innovators and so on, and debate whether that was true or not, or to what extent it was true. But it's certainly, I would argue, been overtaken by the cloud providers in terms of pace of innovation and so on now. So that journey kind of went from don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, to maybe, maybe, maybe. And then it really just became, actually, there's a broad range of use cases where cloud computing is relevant, or cloud providers are a relevant way to do HPC. There's still an open debate about how broadly applicable it is, and how you define cloud, how you define high-performance computing, and whether it's a cloud versus HPC, I tend to argue, is not a great way of thinking about it. Cloud is one way of doing HPC, or cloud provider is one way of doing HPC. You know, on-premises is another way of doing HPC. Equally, you can do HPC things in the cloud and so on. So it's not one versus the other. It's just a different ways potentially of doing the same things. It's kind of how I do it. But the journey has changed from really a tough ask for the relevance of cloud from maybe five to, you know, it was fairly straightforward to say cloud is not really the right way to do this, to where we are now, where it's, in a lot of cases, it's the best way to do things. Not in all cases, but it's become much more credible now.
Lots to dig into here. So first, your comment about the difference in speed of innovation is definitely spot on, definitely something I've noticed. If HPC is considered sort of bleeding edge, it's a very slow bleeding edge, maybe like the pitch drop experiment. It's definitely a totally different speed. And I would like to dig into a little bit that early decision you said of don't use cloud for HPC. There's two things. So first, your observations are kind of in line with what I noticed. I remember, I don't remember a date, maybe or sometime early 2010, so probably 2014-ish, but a cloud vendor had an HPC day. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, what are they calling HPC? Because my definition of HPC is very different, I think, than what they have to offer. It's been interesting to see cloud vendors kind of try to brand what HPC is. And the other thing that kind of comes to mind is like, okay, well, maybe I can take a really simple approach and I'll say, like, if I know that, you know, over 90% of exascale applications use MPI, so like we can look at this from programming models, and MPI is this bread and butter of HPC. Well, even today, why isn't MPI a prominent thing in the cloud? Is that the fault of the HPC community that we haven't demonstrated that it's really useful? Is it an issue with the technology space in terms of like, it's just much harder to connect the machines that are in the cloud data centers because they're much less dense than you'd find in an HPC center? I think there's interesting things to think about, like the actual structure of how the centers are built. Like maybe it's the case, I don't know if this is true or not, but maybe it's the case that when you build a cloud center, it's much more cost effective and quick to build something that isn't as dense, that's sort of, and also more generic. Obviously it's more generic because every system I've encountered in HPC is like a special snowflake. I guess I'm kind of just, I don't have a specific question yet, but I'm responding to what you said. The other thing that you said about cloud versus HPC not being a good way to think about it. I entirely agree with that. I have given talks that are like, this mindset is not productive. I'm of the mindset that we should be working together, but it's definitely hard to go against that, what has become ingrained in people, that it's an adversarial space, if that kind of makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I think there did become a point, as I said, probably came to a peak, you know, I don't know, is it 4 years ago, something like that, when there was that adversarial relationship. Some of the early marketing of some of the cloud providers was probably a little bit overambitious. I mean, in the same way that some of the early marketing from some of the GPU providers was probably a little bit overambitious. If you go back far enough, you remember we used to have some marketing that, you know, I'll reduce it for simplicity, but approximately it came across as, you know, GPU is the fastest way to do compute, full stop. And if you don't agree with this, you're just wrong, which clearly is not in any way representative of all of the different types of computing we used to do in scientific computing and all the different applications and the maturity, different codes and so on. And so you had a similar scenario with the cloud providers. They kind of went through an overconfident phase where there's, you know, cloud is the inevitable future for everything. And if you disagree with us, then, you know, you're just a tin-hogging dinosaur. Or, you know, if you think your on-prem cluster is cheaper than our cloud cluster, then you just fundamentally don't know how to do TCO models. Or so and so. And it became quite an adversarial relationship in that respect. And partly also because the messages at many senior parts of the organization, you know, CIO levels and so on, was often being pitched as to how cloud could save money by, you know, you don't need to hire all these specialist people, we'll just do it all on the cloud and it will magically happen. You know, all of the cloud discussion is so much, much more mature and collaborative now. So the adversarial relationship and the kind of the misunderstanding between both sides is just weakened off enormously from where it was. But there was that point for a couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there's a kind of a period where it did get a bit adversarial. I don't think it's like that anymore, or at least it was not as bad. Depends upon always individuals on both sides, but it has improved. As there's grown more and more respect for the people who come from the cloud community or the people who come from the HPC background, and people have moved between the two backgrounds as well. The cloud companies have all hired a lot of ex-HPC people. So there's been much more of a maturing of the conversation, which I think has helped. And I guess the other comment I would make is, remember when I talked about the kind of the news publications, each having their own character and flavor and all being slightly different in our community, although in theory, they're all news organizations. It's the same with the cloud providers, in that in theory, they're all cloud providers on a common label, but they each have their own character they bring to the conversation, their own spread of technologies, the way they've chosen to develop HPC solutions, the way they've chosen to bring them to market, and, you know, the character of how they engage with their customers and so on. That there are different characters, flavors, whatever we want to call it, between the different cloud providers. And there's, you know, if I take my day job hat off for a second, there's pros and cons to the approaches of each of them. You know, and some of them are better than others in some of the circumstances. And I certainly have my views on the pros and cons of different approaches, but you know, there's value in the pros and cons of each of the approaches being taken, and they are slightly different. And in fact, to go back to what you were saying earlier about kind of how you deploy the infrastructure and then why is an MPI out there and stuff, you can run MPI on, you know, at some level, an MPI application is just a workload, and you can run MPI workloads across cloud infrastructure, even generic cloud infrastructure, but certainly across the stuff that's been tuned for HPC. It might not behave in the way you would expect to behave on a custom on-prem exaflop supercomputer, but that again depends on which cloud provider you're talking about, which part of their technology stack. So putting a day job on for a second, in Azure we have, you know, the commodity cloud infrastructure where you can get a whole load of compute optimized virtual machines connected together by kind of the community of brands as low latency Ethernet, although it's not what HPC community would call low latency, and you can run MPI on the infrastructure, but you're running on an infrastructure that, as you say, is designed for general purpose computing and cost optimized VMs and so on, rather than specifically performance. And then one of the things that we do in a particular way and other cloud providers do in a different particular way, we then have dedicated HPC infrastructure that is exactly the same as you would get in an on-prem supercomputer. Fundamentally underneath, it's a large InfiniBand cluster with HPC levels of low latency, HPC levels of bandwidth, and actually in many cases more bandwidth because there's a better business case in cloud to pay for more bandwidth. And it's the same supercomputer technology you would find in many supercomputer sites. But then you have the debate about how much of that stuff do you deploy where and where availability is in different regions, which kind of goes back to your point earlier about deploying infrastructure that's common across all of our data centers. But even that story has changed in the last couple of years with the build out of the AI capability. The piece of our infrastructure we're building out faster and at greater scale than anything else is AI capability. And that fundamentally is a supercomputer the way anybody in the HPC community would recognize a supercomputer. It's, you know, large clusters of GPUs connected by, and in our case, InfiniBand interconnect, you know, with low latency, high bandwidth, non-tapered, et cetera. So that kind of growth pattern from the clouds to being a very commodity infrastructure to being really building out supercomputing infrastructure at a scale bigger than the traditional HPC community, both in size of the machines and just number of machines, it's just exploded over the last probably, I mean, it's not even 2 years since ChatGPT came out, is it?
Yeah, it's moved really, really quickly. I think that's spot on. And it's interesting because as a user of, I actually use most of the clouds, I feel like what I've gotten good at is figuring out based on my specific use case, which cloud has the best resources for what I need, because there is extreme variance. So for example, running an MPI application, I'm going to probably choose two out of the three clouds, and the third one still has some work to do, and I'll leave it at that. So yes. talking about application design, MPI, AI, very logically, AI is driving the space of innovation. It's a huge customer base. And we're seeing that come down to like the precision of chips to building these new data centers. And I have two questions. So the first is that when you look at general patterns of HPC applications, and then the patterns that you tend to see with ML applications that are getting more deployed in the cloud, so like maybe a leader worker design or something like that, how are they different? And I think my interest is like, does the future of HPC applications look like? Are our HPC applications going to become AI applications? Like, are we going to see physics, chemistry, biology generating surrogate models rather than kind of these traditional computational methods for solving differential equations that we've seen?
Probably. I think it'll be a complementary mix of all of those. So I was never a big fan of the theory that every single workload will end up in a GPU or that every single workload will end up in a cloud. And I'm kind of follow that. I'm not a fan of every single workload will end up as an AI workload. I think there's always reasons why you need that complementary mix of different things. But having said that, clearly, and whether we call it AI or ML is a whole debate in itself, I guess. But machine learning algorithms in the physical sciences have already demonstrated their value in some examples. I can only see that growing. I don't see them fully replacing traditional numerical simulations, but they will absolutely be complementary to it, whether that is, you know, as you say, creating a baseline model that then uses machine learning to create specific, I guess, explore parts of parameter space using a well-founded numerical simulation to start with, or whether it's, you know, doing uncertainty quantification using machine learning, or whether it is doing so kind of using it as a low-cost method to try out a number of different designs before you hone in on the one that needs the full numerical simulation, full resolution numerical simulation to kind of get the best possible answer. There's a whole load of different ways we can complement this, or using machine learning techniques to run some of the kernels faster. There's a lot of different ways that people have been looking at building the two together, but absolutely, I think it will be both for the future, not one or the other. And it'll be different contexts, different environments. It depends on how much your science is useful with a good enough answer. So is a good enough answer quick enough what you need for your science? Or is it, and you know, particularly if you're trying to say, well, if you're trying to validate a theory or not, or whether we go down one particular direction of design versus another, then actually getting, it's kind of like convergence in some respects. So once you get to the point where you're confident you're going in the right direction, and whether it's, you know, 1.0237 or 1.0236, maybe doesn't matter so much. For some applications where it becomes critical to have a high degree of confidence that you have the right answer and that you know you have the right answer, then there's probably a greater weight of numerical simulation rather than machine learning in the mix. So I think it's a mix of those things that come into play.
I'm glad that you called it machine learning, because I feel like over the past 15 years, I've seen like statistical learning and then machine learning, and at some, you know, and then at some point it, you know, then there was deep learning, that was a thing, that was like a phase, and at some point it transitioned into AI, and now like everyone calls everything AI, and I'm like, I'm not sure. I agree with that. It's interesting how our culture changes like that. So I want to talk about something that has been giving my team a really hard time lately, and actually you kind of already mentioned it, and that is getting GPUs. It has been really hard getting, you know, getting the quota, but then actually getting them. Like I could tell you a story of where I put in a request for 32 nodes. So each node had 8 GPUs. And I thought this was very reasonable. And the person I was interacting with basically laughed because she said, there's no way that we're going to get that. We could maybe get you 2 nodes total. So my question is, I guess I have 2 questions. So the first is that it feels like there is a lower supply now with respect to demand. And I would imagine that that's an opportunity for cloud vendors to provision more GPUs. So maybe that issue will get better over time. But I wonder, given that GPUs come from some of the same sources, is there going to be actual contention between sharing these resources from hardware vendors, between traditional HPC centers that want to get them and then cloud vendors?
Yeah. I think inevitably that's happening. It's just because of the sheer growth of, ultimately the AI industry over the last 2 years or so. The pace of growth is absolutely staggering. You know, we never really talk about it publicly, of course, for obvious reasons, but it is enormous. I think one kind of statistic that might help reveal a little bit about the scale of it. So in November 2023, Microsoft listed a machine on the top 500 that came in at number 3. So, it's a decent sized machine for the HPC community. And then, when was it, last month or the month before? It was revealed at our build conference that since that time, so 6 months, we had deployed 10 times that capacity. Is it 10 times? Or did we say 30 times? I lose track. I think we said 30 times that capacity. And so that just gives you an idea of, and clearly we're not telling everything we're doing, but that gives you an idea of the sheer scale and pace of the build out that's going on behind this AI revolution, as it were. And of course, Microsoft's not the only one that's building out the capacity at that pace. Others are doing the same. Meta has been very public about the number of A100 and H100 units they expect to have by the end of such and such a year and so on. So the it's not that the hyperscalers not deploying as much GPU capacity as they absolutely can. They are. There's a lot of significant effort within all the hyperscalers, I guess, to really focus on how to build out as much GPU capacity as possible. But that is driven by the AI revolution, which is bringing in real dollars and real money. And therefore, the GPUs that are available to allocate things that aren't quite in the headline news to the same extent, or aren't quite in the CEO's mind to the same extent, like smaller HPC use cases, gets difficult. And so that comes across as there's no GPUs available, but clearly that's not what's true underneath. There's a huge amount more GPUs deployed this year than there were last year and so on. And that trend will continue for the foreseeable future. That does naturally create some contention for resources. Some of the manufacturers only have so much capacity. They've only got so much factory capacity per year, whether we're talking about chips or whether we're talking about cables or even talking about things like concrete and data center metal and things like that. So yeah, the ability to run an effective supply chain has become a really powerful capability for anybody who wants to become an internationally leading organization. And that's kind of had 2 big shocks that's driven that home recently. One is, the AI growth that we've just been talked about. And the second, of course, was the impact of the COVID pandemic a few years ago on supply chains and so on. And so the two of those effects together have kind of really driven home how a quality supply chain is at least as much about securing your supply, your supply of goods, as it is about negotiating the best price for those, which is why we've seen the prices of certain components escalate enormously in the community, because people have realized that actually you can charge whatever price you like for it, but if you don't have it, then it's no use. So getting something half the price but not having it till next year or the year after is not as valuable as just getting hands on it now and churning out good science with it or getting good return on investment in a business. And so long way around of saying yes to some extent.
So I was going to ask how you untangle sort of something that is hypey versus real signal, but it kind of sounds like based on the customer demand that this is all real signal and you don't really need to question if it's hype and that a company is going to make a decision to deploy and make all these new centers with GPUs and then, oops, we were wrong about that prediction about the future.
No, it's the other way around. We are buying every GPU we can in order to meet customer demand, which in turn means we're buying every bit of data center and power we can and so on. So that, and that's totally driven by customer demand. It's not, you know, nobody's going to deploy the scale of the infrastructure just on spec on the hope that somebody turns up for it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm hearing. Okay, so given that at least right now, so this might change, of course, into the future as more GPUs are deployed, but given that right now it's hard to get GPUs, and also based on just the subjective experience that as a scientist, as a researcher, when you do experiments on the cloud with GPUs, like someone needs to do a study on this, like with galvanic skin response and heart rate. It is stressful when you are running something at scale with GPUs because you're constantly aware of like, okay, the cost right now is like this imaginary ticker in my mind that's just like blowing through it. Have I hit my retirement funds yet? Am I going to jail? Like that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, do you think that there could be a future where perhaps the HPC community mainly runs their stuff on CPUs because they can't get the GPUs and maybe sometimes the GPUs are cost prohibitive?
Yeah, actually, there's all sorts of interesting questions kind of folded up in that. So the answer to the last bit is yes, partly because one of the reasons a lot of applications jumped to GPUs in the early days was to access more memory bandwidth. Now that we have CPUs with HBM on them or large, huge level three caches and so on, actually the memory bandwidth on CPUs is considerably improved from where it was in relative terms. So a lot of those applications actually probably work quite well on GPUs, on CPUs now, and get a lot of significant performance. So for some applications, the performance difference between the two, is a lot more friendly than it used to be. And then certainly once you take into economics into account and availability into account, then I think if you're buying your HPC machine to actually deliver certain amounts of science and certain amounts of impact to your business and not focusing on things like top 500 numbers and so on, then CPU infrastructure is still a very, very solid way to go and has been for a long time. There's a lot of centers that still focus on power infrastructure because fundamentally it delivers the business results that are required, but albeit not getting you the top 500 numbers or whatever. So to that second part of it, absolutely yes. Probably less so about price and more just about it just makes the best sense for overall application performance and price and everything else together and just availability. To the other point about kind of sweating yourself about the cost of the assets, as it were, or the cost of using the compute, it's not as if the cost has never been there. I mean, the DOE invests hundreds of millions or billions of supercomputing and over the course of a cycle. That's real money that's coming from somewhere, and somebody somewhere is sweating very much to justify that. The only difference is the end user doesn't kind of feel that pressure in the same way. And the same is true, at a university who goes and convinces the president of the university to invest $1 million in a supercomputer. It works at all scales. We've had this thing over time where we've kind of become ingrained in the HPC community in most cases to assuming and accepting that supercomputing is, or HPC is free at the point of use. And we don't have to worry about the costs because somebody somewhere else in our organization has gone and made the case and done the sweating to justify the cost and get the investment. And now it's free for me to use. And of course, it's not free because you have to generate enough good science with it, enough good outputs that person can then collate into a report about how well the $1 billion was spent and to help justify the next $1 billion and so on. So it's never without having to justify your value, but it's kind of been a less visible to everybody along that chain, certainly to a lot of the users at the end. And the only difference that a pay-per-use model, which could be cloud or could be on-prem. And again, it's this habit of kind of labeling cloud as we mean certain things in our head, but kind of paying at the point of use, which some HPC centers do, both in academia and in some companies, they kind of charge projects on a per-use basis for the capacity. Paying at the point of use forces you to think about the value of what you're doing at the point at which you're doing it. Is this particular piece of science or engineering I'm trying to run, is that valuable to the organization, to the business? And if it is, then you run it and then you incur the cost. And if it isn't, then you don't do it. And so there's pros and cons to both approaches as to how much you kind of put the value of the science right in the mind of the user versus put it in the mind of the person writing the business case once every 3 years or whatever.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I have a very non-traditional view on cost transparency because my impression is that when I use a cloud, I can look up like the cost of compute, of memory, of a license, like down to the second or actually even smaller unit that I'm using it. And really, it's just a difference in responsibility. So as you said, there's this impression that when you use HPC resources, it's free, but it's actually not free. The difference is that me as a user, I do not have the responsibility to think about it. But when I move to the cloud, all of a sudden, I do have that responsibility. And so what that means, it means a different, it requires a different set of practices for when you do an experiment. So for example, what I usually do is I'll have an application, I'll just figure out a design. I do the very simple kind of prototype runs, like just one run, I time things, and I estimate the cost down to the minute so that by the time when I'm actually running the experiments, I'm very confident, and I've added buffer too about like what exactly I'm going to spend. Now, granted that it's more kind of anxiety provoking when you're using GPUs, because it's more, you still have that kind of confidence about what you're going to do. And, you know, I think it's just a different set of tools and practices that people need to learn. And maybe it's just the case that people are averse to that. Now, I do think there are specific things that could be more transparent. So for example, one thing that happens quite often is, I think while HPC has the illusion of freeness, cloud often has the illusion of infinite resources. And so it might be the case that I'm bringing up a cluster, and let's say I need like 30 nodes, and I get 28, and I'm like really excited I got my 28, but then I don't get the last two, and it hits like the timeout condition and everything rolls back. But oh no, I've just paid for those 28 resources and I didn't do anything because I needed to run my MPI application on all 30. And so that's one thing that's hard to kind of get around. I suppose you could make like a reservation or something like that in advance. And then kind of the other related piece of that, and this is a question that I have, I think it would be really nice if I could see more quickly what I'm spending. So for example, it's usually the case that I do an experiment and the costs show up like the next day. Yeah. And I know there's cost calculators, but I'm wondering why there can't be quicker feedback about what I'm spending. And I'm wondering if that's, I'm guessing it's not like a technology problem, but there's something else there.
I suspect it's a case of how different bits of technology are strung together. So, I mean, certainly there's an API somewhere that's picking up what you're using, on the second or minute you're using it, and then it's passing it on to another system that's figuring out exactly what your contract should be charged, which is probably different to other people, and that probably passes it on to another system that then figures out how to sum that up for the end of the day, which passes on to another system which sends you an invoice at an appropriate invoicing period and so on. So I suspect that somewhere along that chain, somebody's made an assumption that, telling the customer the total cost on a daily basis is probably good enough resolution. I suspect there's a capability in the chain to do it on a more fine-grained resolution, but probably nobody's ever really pushed the business case for doing it before. Because of course that means more data being moved around, which means the cost of running the underlying infrastructure is more expensive, which then gets passed on and so on. So there's pros and cons to that, but I don't think there's any fundamental technology block to it that I can think of. It's just a case of somebody's made an assumption about what granularity you kind of need as you go through. But your point at the beginning was, the cloud is not infinite. And that was one of the things I really used to rant about when I was, HPC user, HPC customer, rather than working at a cloud provider, was some of the marketing that used to talk about infinite clouds or virtually, they delimited a little bit with virtually infinite or whatever, or, effectively infinite. And each of the cloud providers has got their own different delimiting phrase, but they all have play the same game, essentially. And of course, it's not. If you have an organizational user who only has a very small amount of HPC resource, maybe you traditionally only got, 100 cores of computing or whatever, then to a good approximation, the cloud is infinite compared to your resource. But for most of the HPC people who are used to talking about much larger quantities of resource in their on-prem environment, not only is the cloud traditionally not infinite, it's actually not even infinite by approximation compared to the size of the clusters we're talking about, particularly when we talk about the big supercomputer size, top 10 sites and so on. That's changed again. We talked about the pace of the growth and the rollout over the last couple of years. So that argument has changed a bit. But there's a maturity aspect to that. So you talked about spinning up machines and getting exactly what you wanted, when you wanted it, and how long it takes them to spin up and become available. I think that's where the supercomputing community probably really hasn't woken up to just how far ahead of them the cloud providers have got in terms of scale and capacity and automation of processes and things like that. There's still an element of a lot of supercomputer centers still thinking that, kind of it's the they're still the biggest deployers of infrastructure and so on. That's not really true anymore. But equally, the cloud providers have got a huge amount of waking up to do that. They're still total babies in this space. And the HPC community have been deploying large-scale infra and figuring out how to make it work and stable and cost-optimized and so on, figuring out support mechanisms for decades. So there's a lot more practical experience there. And so both sides kind of need to be a little bit more honest about the relative position of the other and where they sit and learn from each other a lot more, I think. That's kind of one of my big things, is that neither side is in a position to say they're so far ahead of the other they don't need to listen to the other. Both have opportunities, huge opportunities to learn.
Sounds like we need to have good communication and focus on working together and throw away the cloud versus HPC dichotomy. That is not helping anyone. So practically speaking, how do you think that our two communities can better work together?
Something that none of us in this space are very good at, and that's starting, and myself included, the nature of the technology race we're involved in AI, and the nature of how HPC has always been about leadership and being the biggest and best and fastest, means that essentially we kind of got bragging about how good we are baked into everything we do and the way we think about things and stuff. And this is across both the cloud community and the traditional HPC community. And just kind of taking that step of humbleness and saying, actually, there's a lot I can learn from other organizations who I don't traditionally think of as my peers. That's kind of probably the first important step, is just be willing to recognize that there is something to learn from somebody who's operating at a different scale or a different way, or has got a different background or a different history. And I mean that both organizationally and individually as well. So that's kind of probably step number one. And the second is just to, following up on that, being willing to engage with each other's spheres. So for example, if we looked at this as the only way to collaborate is for all of these cloud providers to come and properly engage with the HPC community. Yes, but equally the opposite is true. The HPC community has to proactively move outside of their traditional conferences and engagement mechanisms and figure out how to engage with the cloud providers in that way as well. Neither side has any inherent right to be collaborated with, kind of need to earn it, and both sides need to be willing to step out into different venues, different forums, different ways of communicating, different ways of collaborating. But fundamentally, it's as you said, communication, being willing to listen. Half of communication is being willing to listen. And that's probably the first step, being willing to learn.
That's really good advice. So we're coming up on time, and I want to have a little bit of fun before we finish up and talk about what might be coming in the future for our communities. So let's play a game. I'm going to call this game Possible Futures. I'm going to give a scenario. It can be real. It can be silly. It doesn't matter. And then you can give one, and we'll just kind of go back and forth. Maybe they'll get more ridiculous. I don't know. Two or three each, whenever we run out. So I will start. Possible future number one: all the money and talent go into industry. Supercomputers are no longer selling on eBay at all, and large scientific centers start to shut down. High performance computing is now entirely done in the cloud, and science funding goes to cloud vendors. Okay, your turn.
Do I respond to that one, or do I think of something more extreme?
You can think of something different. You can respond to that. It's just okay. Like a possible future. You can extend my future, whatever you like. It's a game.
So I'm going to react to that one by saying no way. Or at least otherwise, I desperately hope not. What do I come up with that's more extreme than that? Let me have a think. So actually, it's an interesting one I saw today was Jensen was talking about robotics. I saw some interview he'd done at some point recently. We were talking about robotics and how within a very small number of years, we expect to have a very large number of humanoid robots running around. Now, that's fascinating and interesting itself as a prediction. But what does that mean for supercomputing and for AI? I mean, does it change the nature of, obviously you need a lot of AI to power the robots and all the rest of it. But what does it change for how we use supercomputers and what we use them for? You know, if we're using supercomputers to design machinery or to design vehicles that maybe are now driven by robots rather than driven by humans, and does that change the nature of what we use these things for? So I guess that's kind of my speculative future, is what happens when humans, the nature of what humans do, the things we work on, the things we enjoy, fundamentally changes. How does that change the role of modeling and simulation, and therefore the role of supercomputing in our lives? And particularly, given the proportion of our supercomputing that is aligned, you know, we use that label of national security, which can mean all sorts of different things that we want it to mean at any given point. The proportion of our supercomputers aligned to that, how does that change in the distant future when we're in a world where 3/4 of the biped entities are robots and only 1/4 is left to humans or something?
Okay, that's awesome. So I'm going to extend your vision for my possible future number two. I'm going to say that in the future where we have like a robot task force along with humans, there are services that basically they build models of your entire life and your personality and your memories. And so you have this company that's managing these personalities and these models for people, and they have a database crash and they lose tens of thousands of people's like lives. And so these people, you know, there's a combination of lawsuits. And what eventually happens is another company comes up that aims to actually give people new models. So basically provisioning them with new personalities, new life stories. But then they have another configuration error and they mix up with a database of animal models. And so then there's a complete havoc across the nation where people are roaming the streets. They are barking, they are meowing, they are searching in trash cans for leftover meals. More lawsuits ensue, but then there's the occasional news headline like, well, Uncle Frank is really much better now because he used to be kind of a jerk before, but now he just wants belly rubs.
So either you are way better at this game than I am, or you have been eating some very strange foods in the last 12 hours.
No, I have a very active imagination.
Yeah.
my foods aren't that crazy.
I'm not even sure where to go with that. I mean, I will do it. It's interesting. So we've both been talking about confining ourselves to the one planet. I think almost every piece of science fiction you read kind of projects when humanity exists across multiple planets. And there's no good reason to suppose that won't exist at some point in the future. And so if we extrapolate to that, we would expect supercomputing to be a big part of enabling that, simulating interstellar travel, simulating other worlds and so on, building digital twins of those worlds, like you just talked about, before we build them for real to learn how to do it better and so on. So that could be a really interesting distant future. But then you get down to the point where it kind of comes full cycle because, you know, we are nominally one big human community now, but we have plenty of little tensions between ourselves, between different parts of the worlds. And supercomputing often plays a role in those tensions. But, you know, there's an international competitive activity between different countries protecting technology or enabling different countries to have more competitive economics or more competitive national security capabilities or whatever it is. So I wonder how that plays out when you go to interplanetary scale, where we're no longer competing as to whether the US or China or whatever's got the biggest supercomputer publicly known, but maybe it's whether, you know, the home world Earth has got a bigger supercomputer than, you know, Colony 27 or whatever it is. An interstellar top 500. That's where I'm going.
Yeah. I think probably part of that is maybe we'll use up all of the power on Earth and just totally destroy our planet. But then, you know, the responsibility, if you're like a tech billionaire, so like a CEO of one of these companies, is that you start a rocket company. So all the CEOs are going to launch themselves to other planets and they will have the interstellar top 500. But we'll be back with the robots, like basically in a Matrix type scenario, like they'll be the rulers. And anyway. That was really fun. Thank you for doing that with me. I have one more quick question and then we'll close up. What do you like to do in your free time when you're not thinking about programming and HPC?
I have to think seriously now. So I've got to go into a serious meeting after we've just played that game as well. That should be fun. So what do I like to do in my spare time? I mean, the obvious things about you know, family and so on. But actually, I'll pick on one thing that some people in the community kind of know a bit about me is I'm a fan of Formula One. So I enjoy watching Formula One. I enjoy going to Formula One races when I can. It's not always the cheapest thing to do. But I find it fascinating as a pastime. There's a lot of parallels with HPC actually, but in terms of it being a race where the performance of the driver matters, the technology of the car matters, they execute the strategy of the team, and then the team's ability to execute on that strategy all matters. And so for me, it's this wonderful sport where all of these different things have to come together perfectly. And it's It's the interplay of the human ability and the team ability and the individual and the technology and the way people are finding loopholes or interpretations of the rules of the sport to get ahead and so on. So I enjoy Formula One for all of the sporting and politics that goes with it and the technology that goes with it. It's one thing I kind of do in my downtime to have fun.
That's great to hear. And yeah, actually, Felix talked about Formula One, so I know a little bit now. So Andrew, it was so fun chatting with you today. I had so many questions. We got through some of them, but we had fun too. I have been looking forward to this interview since your epic, I don't know if it's called this, but I call it your mic drop moment at the SC23 panel on converged computing. It's always good to have, you know, you've made it. When
it
you
wasn't
have a mic
meant
drop
as a mic drop moment, but yeah.
You are super fun to talk to. I'm really glad and proud to be part of some of the same communities as you and working towards similar goals. And I am 100% set on this vision of working together, communication toward a better future for all of our scientific and AI use cases. So please don't hesitate to reach out if you have cool stuff to talk about. And I'm looking forward to chatting more, I suppose, on HPC Social.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking more with you, both socially and professionally.